Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining us as we prepare to take a look at a brand new case. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Official, or Deathcast Podcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a number of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, follow the show, and leave a 5-star review. They really do help the show get out to more listeners. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows, along with exclusive content such as the series covering the allegations against Vince McMahon, the Columbine School Massacre, as well as the ongoing look we are taking into the Atlanta child murders. And if you act now up until the 31st of December, you can get half off your first month. And as always, I do need to give a shout out to my very first two Patreon subscribers, Channel and Anthony. Thank you guys so much. You are awesome. All right, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. Before we get really into the meat of the matter concerning the Oakland County child killings, which took place in and around Detroit in 1976-1977, we need to discuss a couple of things. First and foremost, this case may be unique in American true crime history, as the various law enforcement agencies that have been investigating it for over 40 years have continuously remained extremely tight-lipped about what information that they have and what information they don't have. More than that, however, they have also been extremely tight-lipped concerning the suspects that they had when the investigation was originally going on, why they stopped investigating the cases when the main suspect ended up dying, and how this case may tie into various other crimes that were taking place in and around Detroit during the 1970s. Now, a lot of the information you're going to hear during this series may be new to you. Some of this stuff I have known for quite a while. Some of it is also new to me in terms of various suspect names, as well as the links that exist between all of these suspects. A lot of this stuff really didn't come to the public's attention until the last few years due to other reporters filing FOIA requests. Not only other journalists were involved in this, but a number of family members were involved too, trying to get the Michigan State Police to open their mouths and admit that not only did they have viable suspects, but they knew about these suspects at the time of the killings. Now, some of this information you're going to shake your head at and say, you know, I've heard you discuss this before. Particularly information concerning North Fox Island, but also the Louisiana Boy Scout troop that I discussed earlier in the year. And the reason they're going to be brought up is because both of them tie together, but they also have ties which have been shown to be credible and factual to the Oakland County child killers, something I have been saying for a number of years now, but of course, people are jumping on this bandwagon, acting as though it is brand new information, even though those particular ties have been out there for some time. Detroit of the 1970s was a city on the brink of economic and social collapse. Gone were the halcyon days where auto industry money flooded the city streets and the population lived in harmony with one another. During the civil unrest of the 1960s, a major riot had occurred which scared the middle-class white families from the area, leaving behind those who were destitute, both black and white. And this allowed the city to eat itself alive. You look at news coverage now of Detroit, the rampant crime, the corruption among city officials, the drugs. It all really started to fester in Detroit during the 1970s and would explode during the 1980s and continue up until today. Now, the Oakland County child killings, while not really taking place in Detroit proper, lay in the outlying environs of the city, that is the suburbs, areas that were not that far removed from the city, but also in areas far north of the city that were 3 to 4 hour drives up into the wealthier parts of the state, where old money that had fled Detroit after making their fortunes resided in relative comfort, free from the burdens of existence that the majority of people living in Detroit had to deal with. However, as you're going to see during the unfurling of all of this, that old money, at least parts of it, was responsible, in my opinion, for some of the suffering that was occurring in these lower class areas in and around Detroit. Now, the first area we are visiting is called Ferndale, Michigan. It's roughly 10 miles north from the center of downtown Detroit. It was a middle to lower middle class community. On the afternoon of February 15th, 1976, 12-year-old Mark Douglas Stebbins was at the American Legion Hall, where his mother, Ruth, was working. Now, some reports indicate that his mother was there because there was a party for her job going on. However, according to information given by some of the victims' families, Ruth was actually there working at the American Legion Hall, where a pool tournament was taking place. Now, February 15th was a Sunday, and Mark asked for and received permission from his mother to leave so that he could walk the 4 blocks to the family home and watch a movie on television. His mother became concerned when Mark was not home when she returned home that evening and immediately contacted the Ferndale Police Department. Missing posters using the previous year's school photograph immediately went up around town, but there was no trace of Mark Stebbins, who was listed as being in the 7th grade at Lincoln Junior High, just under 5 feet tall with strawberry blonde hair. Unfortunately, Mark Stebbins is going to be found murdered on February 19th, 1976. At roughly 11:30 a.m. on that morning, a man by the name of Mark Bodeheimer left his office, which was located at the Fairfax Plaza in Southfield, which is roughly 4 miles from where Mark was last seen, and found the body lying against a brick wall that separated the parking lot of the Fairfax Plaza from an adjoining strip mall. Stebbins was found lying on his back, wearing the same clothing he had been wearing the date of his disappearance, with his hands crossed over his chest. Now, this information I'm about to share here was not released at the time. In fact, the police went to great lengths to state that Mark was not sexually assaulted in any way. However, according to his autopsy, his body showed signs of both anal and oral penetration. There was also a mark on the back of his head, two concentric circles, which another researcher has speculated may have come from a double-barreled shotgun being jammed in the back of his head. Obviously, the police are all over this crime immediately, sending out a net to try and locate anyone who was in this plaza on the morning Mark's body was discovered. They make contact with a man who was walking his dog during the early morning hours at roughly 9:30, and the man informed the officers that he had not noticed any body lying against this brick wall during that period of time, leading the police to conclude that Mark Stebbins' body had been placed there at some point after. Mark's death is officially going to be listed as asphyxiation. Also of note in the autopsy report is the fact that Mark's wrists and ankles showed abrasion marks, which indicated to the medical examiner that he had been bound during some point of his captivity. There are also blood stains present in the hood of his jacket, which indicated that the abrasions on the back of his skull had occurred prior to death. Now, the police made a couple of missteps in this case. First and foremost, they threw a blanket over the body, ostensibly to preserve the crime scene, but in fact, contaminating it by doing so. They also did not really track down a lot of the leads that came in to their conclusion. And we see this in other cases as well, most notably the Atlanta child killings, which I am currently recovering over on the Patreon page, which I will add seems to share a lot of characteristics with the Oakland County child murders. The police also failed to notify the Sheriff's Department crime lab or the state police when Mark Stebbins was discovered. And Stebbins' body is transported directly to the police station as opposed to the morgue, where the clothing that Mark was wearing was removed. Now, it should be noted that these crimes are also called the babysitter murders, as people erroneously believed that all of the children who end up being murdered were well taken care of, that all of their clothing had been cleaned and pressed prior to their murders. In point of fact, Stebbins did not appear to have been bathed, and only the outer garments that he had worn had been laundered. His underwear was dirty, and he had been wearing it for a number of days, probably for the entirety of his confinement. The following day, the Southfield Police Department receives a tip from a parole officer. This officer had a repeat sex offender in his caseload who both lived and worked near the site that Mark's body was discovered. This was 35-year-old Archibald Archie Edward Sloan. Sloan had an extremely long police record, all involving child sexual abuse of boys. In fact, most information indicates that he had been in trouble with the law for these types of activities at least since the time that he was 13 years old. And at this period of time, February 1976, he's on parole for such crimes. On the night of February 15th, 1976, that's the day that Mark Stebbins went missing, Sloan contacted the Southfield Police Department and let them know that he was working late at the garage where he was employed. This was the McCracken's Service Center located on 10 Mile Road. Now, ostensibly, the reason that Sloan contacted the police is because during this period of time in cities like Southfield, the police would drive around, and if they saw lights on in a business, they would stop and check to find out what was going on, whether everything was all right, if there was a burglary going on, that sort of thing. And Sloan, again, ostensibly contacted the police to let them know that he was working there and that there was no need for them to stop by. This particular statement to the police, to me, seems extremely suspect, especially given Sloan's prior history and the location of where he was calling from in relation to where Mark Stebbins' body was discovered. And before we get too deep into the woods on this thing, I do have to point out that the majority of these pedophiles that we're going to be discussing in this series were known and or knew one another. And in fact, according to official documents, were in cahoots with each other more often than not in the course of their various criminal activities. This includes Archie Sloan. Now, I can't say with certainty whether Mr. Sloan was involved in the disappearance, assault, and murder of Mark Stebbins. My personal opinion is that there's a very good possibility that he at the very least had knowledge of it, and the timing of his phone call on the night that Mark disappeared is extremely suspicious. Back to February 19th, roughly an hour after Mark Stebbins' body is discovered, the police place a man under surveillance who, at least according to official documents, is the last person known to have seen Mark alive. There's a 24-year-old by the name of John Crosby. According to reports, Crosby had seen Mark leaving the American Legion Hall and offered him a ride home. However, there is no disposition as to whether or not Mark accepted this ride. What we do know is that this surveillance team observed Crosby removing a white cooler from the back of his vehicle that was said to have had strawberry blonde hair on it. We also know that the Crosby and Stebbins families were known to one another, and that Mark's older brother, Mike, is quoted as stating that Crosby was a quote-unquote scary dude. However, other than this surveillance and the questioning of John, there doesn't seem to have been any further work done by the police to either make him an official suspect or clear him of any involvement. But that doesn't mean the police have stopped looking. After receiving the phone call about Archie Sloan, the police go and interview Sloan on February 22nd. Sloan agrees to allow police to search his vehicle, a 1966 Pontiac Bonneville. Sloan gives the officers an alibi agrees to take a lie detector test, which he supposedly passes, and Sloane is cleared by the police. As always, when discussing lie detector tests, I have to point out that lie detector tests are a highly suspect pseudoscience, which is why they are not admissible in court. In this case, the individual who administered this test, his results in other lie detector tests given to suspects in these murders were later refuted by other so-called experts within this field, meaning that his reading of the results was found to be faulty and or incorrect. So the idea that Sloane passed this polygraph where he stated he had no foreknowledge of Stebbins' disappearance and murder has to be looked at with a skeptical eye. What we do know now is that hair found inside of Sloane's car matched a hair found on Mark Stebbins, but also on a future victim. It's a mitochondrial match, meaning that it either came from this unknown perpetrator or from a family member of that individual. But this too has to be taken with a grain of salt, as we have seen in recent years, time and again, situations where DNA testing has been found to be faulty and or incorrect, and individuals are charged and convicted of a crime for which they are innocent based on it. And I say that not trying to upset any family members who may be listening to this particular series, but simply to present all of the facts, which is that DNA evidence is not infallible, despite what we have been led to believe by both law enforcement, Hollywood, and scientists. Now, there are some other things going on in this general geographic area that concern other aspects of this case. However, as I want to try and focus on single aspects of the case in each episode, we're going to discuss those other things in their respective parts. So after these interviews and lie detector tests, the police continue to search, and it would appear that they're searching fruitlessly. There's really no new information coming in, however, they're still getting tips about both Sloane and Crosby. Now, Crosby ends up getting arrested in September of that year, specifically September 13th, where he's at a Dairy Queen on Nine Mile Road standing behind a 13-year-old girl, and he presses his penis against the girl while they're standing in line. He then does this to the girl's older sister, who goes off on him. Witnesses state that Crosby then calls the young girl a fucking whore and then left the store. He's going to end up being arrested for this. However, at the time of this recording, I can find no disposition of that arrest. Now, of the Stebbins murder, police are really baffled, and they keep telling the media that there is no evidence of any type of sexual assault in Mark's death, which we now know to be a lie. And business seems to go on as usual. Our attention is now going to shift to another suburb of Detroit, which is located roughly 14 miles north of downtown Detroit and roughly 9 miles north of Fairfield, where Mark Stebbins disappeared. This is the city of Royal Oak. On December 22nd at roughly dinner time, 12-year-old Jill Robinson was at home with her mother. At the time we're talking, news reports state that she had a big row with her mother over dinner preparations, loaded a backpack, got on her bike, and ran away from home. It has since come out that while Jill did in fact have this disagreement with her mother, she was not running away, but was instead intending to ride to her father's house, which was roughly 1 mile from where Jill lived with her mother. A witness would later tell police that he saw Jill riding in the direction of her father's house. At 11:30 p.m., Jill's mother, Carol, contacted the Royal Oak Police Department and listed her daughter as missing. It should be noted that given the distance between the locations where these children went missing, as well as the fact that during this period of time, law enforcement departments were really wanting to share information with one another, Jill Robinson's disappearance was not linked to that of Mark Stebbins. This would not happen for a little while. Jill's body ends up being discovered in the early morning hours of December 26, 1976, the day after Christmas. Jill was found kind of lying in the woods on the shoulder of I-75 in the northbound lane. She was just north of exit 69 at 16 Mile Road, which was within sight of the Troy Police Department. The police noted very quickly that Jill had been killed from a shotgun blast to the head. Although it has been noted by those familiar with the case that her autopsy indicates that she had been asphyxiated prior to being shot. Obviously, the police are in high gear again, looking for motives, links, anything concerning Jill's disappearance as well as her murder. On January 10th, 1977, the Michigan State Police filed a report from an interview they did with a motorist who was traveling northbound on the freeway. Quote, spotted a light blue 1967 Pontiac Tempest. Car was parked on the shoulder of I-70 north of 12 Mile Road. He observed two people in the car but could give no further description. As he passed the vehicle, it pulled back onto I-75 and continued northbound until just north of Big Beaver Road in the area where the victim was found. The Tempest pulled onto the shoulder of the road and stopped. Again, the motorist advised that he continued on his way and could give no further information. He did state that he was certain of the year of the car as he had owned one previously, and the paint on the car was faded and the right tail lens was broken in the corner emitting a white light. Jill's murder is eventually going to be tied into those known as the Oakland County child killer crimes. And there has been some speculation from members of law enforcement as to why she alone had been shot, with one former member of the task force postulating that the killer had carried Jill to where her body was found, bringing a shotgun along with them, and that when they dropped Jill's corpse to the ground, air that was still trapped inside of the body had escaped her mouth, making the killer believe that the child was still alive and moaning, and that because of this, the killer had then shot her in the face. Another theory put out by another member of law enforcement is that Jill had bitten her abductor and been shot because of this in an effort to try and make identification via bite marks more difficult. I have problems with this first theory, however, in that, to the best of the public's knowledge, there is no evidence to suggest that Jill was shot where she was found. If she had been, there would be indicators from such an explosion on the ground around her body. There would be debris from Jill's head in the vicinity of where she was discovered, such as skin and bone fragments, as well as blood spatter of some type, as despite the fact that Jill was already dead, there would still be some lingering residue of blood in that section of her body. I personally think that it's more probable that the killer, whose target seems to have primarily been boys, in fact did this to Jill simply out of disgust over the fact that she was a female victim. We're going to get into that in a later episode, but that is my theory as to why Jill was shot in the face and the others were not. This despite the fact that there was one other female victim. Getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, I don't think that all of the victims were killed by the same perpetrator. Much like the Atlanta child murders, I believe that this was a ring of pedophiles, which there is ample evidence to support, and that multiple members of this ring committed murders on behalf of this ring, which would explain why Jill was shot in the face and why the other victims were more ceremoniously discarded, their arms crossed across their chest, that type of thing. Again, it's speculation on my part, but that speculation is based upon years of researching these types of horrific crimes. The investigation into Jill's disappearance and murder turned up a number of things. First and foremost, that her bicycle had been found the day after Jill left home, abandoned behind a hobby shop. We do know at the crime scene that one set of footprints was found in the snow near Jill's body, and it's presumed that the killer had carried Jill over his right shoulder, i.e. his strong side, and had dropped her from that position. However, there is no evidence to indicate that there were any fibers or hairs found on Jill's body. Shifting focus yet again, we are going to the city of Berkeley, which is, again, roughly 14 miles from downtown Detroit in a northwestern direction. On January 2nd, 1977, 10-year-old Christine Mihalich walked from her home to a 7-Eleven located on 12 Mile Road. She went there to purchase a teen magazine. Somewhere around 3 p.m. in the afternoon, as with the other two victims at this point, her mother fairly quickly notifies authorities that Christine is missing. There are posters put up throughout the city, but no one seems to have seen anything. We know Christine arrived at the 7-Eleven. We know that she purchased the magazine. But outside of that, Christine's whereabouts are unknown for the next 19 days. Before we get into discussing the discovery of her body, I want to point that out fairly quickly. 19 days is quite a bit longer than the first victim, Mark Stebbins, was missing. It is longer than Joe Robinson was missing. Stebbins was found fairly quickly, only 3 days after disappearing. Jill was found roughly a week after her disappearance. Christine, almost a month after her disappearance. This leads us to two trains of thought. One, that Christine was held captive for this entire period of time, and the abuse that she went through was well beyond that of the other victims in this series of crimes. Or that she was held captive and alive for a short period of time and then disposed of. What am I talking about when I say that? Well, when Christine was found, her body was frozen. It was, remember, it's the dead of winter. However, there is no evidence to state when she died. We know from killers such as Richard Kuklinski that it is possible to freeze a body right after killing the victim to throw off the police in their efforts to try and determine a time of death. And as it's believed by most researchers and law enforcement that those responsible for these crimes had money behind them, it's not outside the realm of possibility that Christine may have been murdered within a few days of her abduction and then frozen in, you know, a freezer before her body was disposed of. And one of the suspects that we're going to talk about in a future episode, in fact, did have access to just such a freezer. Unfortunately, however, unless there's a crack in this case involving one of the suspects or person of interest who are still alive, we will likely never know the reality of the situation. On January 21st, 1977, Christine Melich's body is discovered at roughly 11:45 a.m. On that morning, a mailman by the name of Jerome Wozni was out delivering mail along Bruce Lane in Franklin, Michigan, which was and still is a fairly affluent area. This area was heavily wooded at the time that the mailman was driving down the street, and he later told police that he was drawn by the flash of something brightly colored in the snow. Wozni pulls to the side of the road, gets out, and walks towards it, realizing upon reaching this object that is in fact a child's body, at which point Wozni runs back to his mail truck and contacts the police. Some reports state that Christine was found frozen, sitting in an upright position, while others state that she was more in a fetal position with her arms crossed over her chest, while another report states that she was lying on her back with her arms over her chest. In any event, Christine was frozen. And during her autopsy, it was found that she had died from asphyxiation with trace amounts of carbon monoxide being discovered in her bloodstream. Some, including the police, have theorized that this could be because Christine was driven around in the trunk of a car, presumably still alive, and that at which point she's removed from the car, taken out into this wooded area, and then killed. However, my personal opinion on this, and again, it's just opinion, is that Christine probably had the carbon monoxide in her lungs from being transported during her 19 days of captivity. Either the day of her abduction or at some point during the 19 days she was gone, she was placed into the trunk of a car for transportation. So after the discovery of Christine's body, the Michigan State Police realized that there's a lot of similarities between these three abductions and murders, and they release statements saying that they believe that there is a killer on the loose who is preying upon young boys and young children in the metropolitan Detroit area. Obviously, this creates a massive panic. Now, a few things about the crime scene itself where Kristen's body was discovered. There's only one set of footprints, those belonging to the mailman, which the police describe away as being the result of an evening snowfall, their theory being that Kristen's body was either placed there the prior day or at some point during the night, and that snowfall had obscured the perpetrator's footfalls. They also noted that a news helicopter had been flying overhead when Kristen's body was being recovered, and that because of this, any evidence that may have been on the scene was blown away in the wash of the rotor blades. Police also found front and rear bumper indentations in the snow on either side of the road, which were linked to a 1967 Pontiac Tempest or Le Mans, or a Buick Skylark. One of the officers investigating would later state that he was certain that it was a Le Mans. However, the vehicle indentation indicated a vehicle with a single tailpipe, and researchers have shown that the 72 and 73 Le Mans both have dual tailpipes. According to police reports, quote, a 1964 to 1967 Pontiac Tempest or Skylark made these impressions, and it's thought by law enforcement that the individual disposing of the body had driven in and done a K-turn, hitting the snow as they did so. It is important to note that a hair that is discovered on Christine's body is going to be linked to a person of interest in this case in the 2010s. As I stated a few moments ago, after the discovery of Christine's body, the police announced that all three of these murders are connected. On February 20th, 1977, a news report comes out that states, quote, three Flint men accused of forcing boys into homosexual acts. More arrests are expected in an investigation of alleged sexual exploitation of juvenile boys, an assistant Genesee County prosecutor said Saturday. Three Flint men have been arrested, and a fourth is sought on charges that they forced adolescent boys to commit homosexual acts. Assistant prosecutor Lenore Ferber said as many as 75 more boys may be questioned as the investigation continues. The three Flint men are charged with using gifts, threats, and physical force to persuade more than 30 boys to engage in sodomy, oral sex, and lewd photography sessions. Earlier, prosecutor Robert F. Leonard reported there appeared to be no connection between the three Flint men and Francis D. Sheldon, the missing Ann Arbor millionaire whose 835-acre Fox Island near Traverse City was linked to magazines depicting homosexual activity involving young boys. Sheldon, missing since last summer, is sought by state police on criminal sexual misconduct charges. Three of the defendants in the Genesee County case are Christopher Bush, Douglas Bennett, and Gregory Green. The men allegedly picked up boys as hitchhikers and by working as counselors in community service groups. One of the defendants worked for a time as the coach of a youth basketball team, a source said. Leonard said the three arrested men were not part of an organized ring, but he acknowledged that some of the boys had been passed from defendant to defendant. Leonard said the inquiry began 8 weeks ago, approximately December 26, 1976, after a school principal noticed a man hanging around a school and talking with boys. After seeing one boy leave with the man, the principal contacted police. Yes, this is information that ties into what we're going to be talking about in later episodes, but the reason I bring that up is the police are kind of stalemating in their investigation, insisting that there is no form of sexual abuse present on any of the victims, which we now know to have been false. On February 22, 1977, the Detroit News comes out and states that there are links between the child sex ring mentioned in the previous article and the Oakland County child slayings, something that the police are going to vehemently deny exists, which from the previous article you can see the police are going to great lengths to downplay the idea that this ring is in any way, shape, or form organized. However, the evidence available to the police during that period of time and still today indicates that it was anything other than what the police were stating. This was a highly organized ring and operated not only throughout the state, but throughout the country. And before people go jumping on me for spreading conspiracy theories, this isn't a conspiracy theory. This is something factual and historical that you're going to see in the future episodes of how this ring, which very possibly, almost certainly, is tied to the Oakland County child killings, had its tendrils spread throughout the entirety of the United States and was, in fact, engaged in, if not the trafficking of victims with other rings that were discovered, at the very least was engaged in the dissemination of child abuse paraphernalia, that means child porn, with these other rings. I'm going to end this week's episode by reading the report from the Detroit News. Oakland County link probed in sexual exploiting of boys by Richard Willing, news staff writer. An investigation into the alleged sexual abuse of young boys, which already has produced three arrests in Flint, will be extended in Oakland County. Oakland County prosecutor L. Brooks Patterson confirmed today that information developed in the Flint investigation suggests that some of the victimized boys had been procured in Oakland County. Officer Thomas Waldron said, "It is his understanding that Oakland County is faced with a large number of complaints similar to those made in Flint, where an estimated 30 prepubescent boys were allegedly forced to commit sex acts with men, with each other and before cameras, but Patterson said he is unaware of any increase in the usual number of scattered instances of homosexual complaints in Oakland County." Patterson emphasized that the cases are seemingly unrelated to the murders of Mark Stebbins, a 12-year-old Ferndale boy sexually molested and then killed last year. Walden said Oakland County investigators have interviewed two of the men arrested in Flint, have given them lie detector tests, and have concluded the men are not suspects in the Stebbins case. The three Flint men, Douglas Bennett, 19, Gregory Green, 26, and Christopher Bush, 40, were bound over for trial in the last 2 weeks on multiple charges of CSC. using gifts, threats, and physical force to persuade the boys to engage in sodomy, oral sex, and lewd photography sessions. The boys, who ranged in age from 10 to 14, were discarded as undesirable once they reached puberty, according to a police source. The men met the boys by picking them up as hitchhikers and by working as counselors and community service groups. Green had served time in Orange County, California for a sex offense involving a boy and paroled to Flint, according to the same source. Genesee County Prosecutor Robert F. Leonard said yesterday that the defendants may have passed boys from one to another and the scheme may have nationwide ties. He said his office is investigating the possibility the defendants may have been linked to Grosse Pointe millionaire Francis D. Sheldon, missing since allegations that his youth camp on Lake Michigan near Traverse City was a homosexual haven became public last fall. Bush is free on $1,000 cash bond, while Bennett and Green are in Genesee County Jail in lieu of $15,000 and $75,000 bonds, respectively. Flint police have also obtained a warrant against a fourth man allegedly involved in the scheme. Gonna point out one thing here in that this article. The age is given a wrong. We will discuss that in a future episode, very possibly next week. For now, however, we're going to end the show at this point with three young children having gone missing and having been discovered dead by asphyxiation in the span of roughly 12 months. I hope you guys are enjoying this episode. And until next time, stay morbid.